Sunstone does not necessarily endorse the opinions expressed in these presentations, nor the character of the presenters. Presenters must follow Sunstone's code of conduct, available online at bit.ly/sunstoneconduct. Those who violate it are thereafter banned from Sunstone events. Since this session was recorded, multiple people reported having been sexually abused by panelist Tom Kimball. To provide opportunities to learn from the past and to keep the historical record intact, Sunstone will continue to make this session available. For more information, visit sunstone.org/connect/news. If you or someone you know has experienced sexual assault, call the National Sexual Assault Hotline at 1-800-656-4673.
The 2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 374, Stages of Faith, Mormon Encounters, a panel featuring Tom Kimball, Scott Denhalter, D. Jeff Burton, Dan Weatherspoon, and Kenny Kemp. Welcome to Session 374, Stages of Faith. My name is Tom Kimball. I'm the Marketing Director for Signature Books, and I'm giving the paper today, and I'm also the moderator. It's nice to have absolute power. After I give my paper, we'll be pleased to hear some comments from Dan Weatherspoon, and we'll hear them in this order, okay? Dan Weatherspoon, and then we'll hear from Scott Dan Weatherspoon is the editor of Sunstone Magazine. We'll then hear from Scott Denhalter, who is an editor of Cyber Saints column for Sunstone Magazine, as well as a webmaster and writer. Also, then we'll hear from Jeff Burton, who is the author of the book For Those Who Wonder, one of the three mainstays of this type of study, in my mind. Okay. He's also a columnist for Sunstone for the column Borderlands. And then our anchor man will be Kenny Kemp. Kenny Kemp is a filmmaker, a repentant attorney, author of the series of books that place Jesus into the action of his own parables. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Okay. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pierian spring. There, shallow droughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. Alexander Pope. I began employment as Christmas help at the LDS Church-owned Desert Bookstore in 1995. I've always enjoyed talking about Mormon history and issues. Like the nymphs at the Pierian Springs, I found it intoxicating to introduce books and ideas to people with doctrinal, historical, and spiritual questions. I guess being a Mormon bookseller and occasionally being the gatekeeper of hidden knowledge is my equivalent of being a rock star. Each time I read a new book or gave a customer a sales pitch, I had the opportunity to rethink a Mormon doctrinal concept or point of history. I think it's natural that someone who really cares about Mormon issues would in time try to fit these ideas into strands of a complex, personalized worldview that, in spite of loose ends, would hopefully intertwine like a carefully woven tapestry. As a salesman, I found that I often formulated new ideas as I spoke, often trying new ideas on for size in the process of bookselling. Once I mentioned to a regular client, if a person reads Mormon books and genuinely cares about their content, there only seems to be two paths, fundamentalism and agnosticism. For years, I'd been reading LDS nonfiction and was unsure if I had unconsciously chosen one of these paths. For some time, the polar concepts of fundamentalism and agnosticism were the only yardstick with which I had to discuss what I perceived as the ultimate outcome of any well-read Mormon experience. Enter James Fowler. While cleaning, sorting, and pricing used volumes at Benchmark Books, my co-worker and mentor, Dan Weatherspoon, and I often talked about philosophy and its implications in a Mormon model. Dan's PhD is in the philosophy of religion, and we often spoke of shamans, Nietzsche, Joseph Smith, and how different cultures perceive the path of life and what it all means. During one of these sessions, Dan mentioned that he had met James Fowler on a plane, and we began discussing his book, Stages of Faith, which Fowler based in part on 600 lengthy interviews he and a team of researchers conducted with men, women, children from ages 4 to 88, including Jews, Catholics, Protestants, agnostics, and atheists. Aside from the fact that Fowler is not a Mormon, his six stages of faith seem to fit nicely within my tradition, and this paper is an attempt to provide a Mormon example of his work. Through Fowler, I've been able to nuance and transform my either-or theory into what I think is a healthier tool in defining the Mormon path. I find that I'm mostly interested in Fowler's stages 3 through 5 because they are more relevant to me at this time. I realize that stages aren't actual things, but merely a framework to illustrate human development as it unfolds in a predictable sequence. Most stage theorists agree that people must spend time in every stage, and each is necessary as it builds on all of the previous. Fowler's stages of faith concepts enables me to be charitable to those who have been critical of me in my journey and provides possible paths that enable me to feel comfortable in the culture of my youth and heritage. Fowler calls stage 1 the intuitive projective stage. He suggests that this is representative of 2 to 6-year-olds. At this stage, the child interlinks myth with reality. Early in life, the child is unable to differentiate where the myth begins and where reality ends. It's a time of asking what and why ad nauseum. It's also when the child learns that the world is a safe environment or whether or not to trust. This introduction is an important step towards the second stage. Fowler calls stage 2 the mythic literal stage, where the child works to separate the real from the make-believe and to form a narrative of one's own life. Stories are important at this stage. The child can be trapped in the narrative, though still not able to draw from them the conclusions about the general meaning of life. This is a healthy stage for those who are in the age range of 2 through 12. Those in this stage also have a them or us concept that is often void of the complexities of a diverse community. This tribal concept justifies the individual in viewing those who are not the us to mean less than equal. The other exists, but can easily be hated or forgotten. Stage 3, or the synthetic conventional stage, is of course the most interesting stage. Fowler talks about it in terms of the individual trusting the group for social ideas and standards. An individual in this stage will trust that the institution would have already dedicated significant time and energy in formulating concepts that are based on tried and true principles, or that these mandates come directly from revelation, and the individual need only to defer to the group's teachings as God's will. I like to call this stage the return missionary stage. Return missionaries would have gained from parents and church leaders a complex understanding of the LDS plan of salvation, have a confidence in the purpose of life, know why good and bad things happen in the lives of people, and have the ability to articulate why God created the universe, the purpose of humanity, and why he or she is an integral and meaningful component within this plan. For Latter-day Saints, this worldview can be very complex and gives meaning not only to the metaphysical, but to the rational science behind God's creative power and motivations. The worldview of the Latter-day Saint is vast in its complexity. For Mormons, this is a very comfortable stage to be in. Importantly, Fowler points out that most adults never leave this stage. Stage 4, or the individuative reflective faith, is described as when a person shakes off community and social pressure and begins to choose for themselves whether something is true or not, regardless of the church group's social norms. In a specific Latter-day Saint context, this is when the individual begins to explore the loose strands in Mormonism and begins to pull them in an effort to tidy them up in their mind. I've observed this to be true for many in the Mormon book culture. For example, it's not difficult to find quotes by Brigham Young and others who say that the Adam God concept will have to be accepted by everyone and how important it is in explaining the nature of deity. And then one will just as easily find statements by Orson Pratt and Bruce R. McConkie denouncing the same doctrine as heresy. These contradictions invite readers to make decisions one way or another that will ultimately place them at odds with the ideologies of a significant portion of their culture. Another example is President John Taylor's politically incorrect statement that the reason why black people are allowed to survive Noah's flood was so that Satan could have representation on the earth. The majority of my extended family and many of my missionary companions would probably not even raise an eyebrow to President Taylor's statement, and I myself would not have given Taylor's statement a second look when I was younger. But in time, the very act of questioning this statement was, for me, in essence, pushing my fist into stage 4. Stage 4 can be an angry stage when the believing Latter-day Saint feels that on some level that they have been deceived by parents, leaders, or by high authorities, historical or modern. I think of this stage as the throwing the baby out with the bathwater stage. The anger of the perceived betrayal blinds people to the good offered even by a flawed system. There are many reasons a person can enter into stage four, and most people who enter stage four stay there their entire life. Those in stage four begin to look at the world with from a naturalistic standpoint, devoid of metaphysical or paranormal events. Fowler points out two possible indicators that allow a person to know if he or she is in stage four. One is that a person begins to view themselves as an outsider looking in at the church. The other indicator is agnosticism. For me, agnosticism is the crescendo of stage four. I spoke to Fowler at the Salt Lake 2002 Sunstone Symposium on this issue, and he told me that the only way out of stage four is to once again experience the metaphysical. He told me that in order to have a metaphysical event, one has to stand in its way. He used the imagery of having to stand in the railroad tracks in order to be hit by a train. Naively, I asked his advice on this. He suggested that I start praying again. In Fowler's book, he talks about how difficult it is to understand even one stage ahead. For this reason, I have to talk about stage five in speculative terms. Fowler calls this stage conjunctive faith. He said that finding a simple description was a frustrating process, though he gives several metaphors. For example, he states that it's like looking at a field of flowers with a wide-angle lens and a microscope simultaneously, or discovering that one's parents are remarkable people, not just because they're your parents. I perceive that an element of stage five for Latter-day Saints is the process of forgiving the people or the system that has betrayed them, real or perceived, and finding possible ways to live among the LDS tradition. The problems still exist, but the individual is able to find meaning and peace among contradiction and irony. I speculate that many Latter-day Saints in stage four or N5 would not move on to another religion, for this, in my mind, would for them be only exchanging problems for problems, when one of the Mormon Church's strengths is community. Traditionally, Mormons are excellent at taking care of the tangible needs of the active members of their community. At age seven, I ran through a sliding glass door, and within hours, members of the church anonymously cleaned up the glass and blood and made arrangements for replacing the door. 3 days later, my mother had to approach the Relief Society president, the local women's leader, and request that the amount of food being delivered to the house be reduced. Within 24 hours of moving into a small outback town in Australia, my wife and I began enjoying fellowship with several LDS families who quickly became close, long-term friends. The community of saints, in my mind, is the baby in the bathwater. I feel that the Latter-day Saints who are moving into stage five would look for strategies within the LDS community, though they may adopt elements from other traditions. Fowler speculates that very few people make it into stage five, and that most people in this stage stay here for the extent of their life. Stage six, or the universalizing faith, according to Fowler, is exceedingly rare. It is a stage of actualization and incarnation of the absolute love and justice that can only be sensed or approximated by those at earlier stages. For those who are capable of stage six, he explains, life is both loved and held too loosely. Such persons are ready for fellowship with persons at any other stage and from any other faith tradition. As virtual incarnations of divine love, persons in stage six often act with little regard for self-preservation or social convention. Their radical actualization of universal morality feels to many to be subversive. As Fowler points out, many persons in this stage often die at the hands of those whom they hope to change. He refers to a few modern examples of people who reflect stage six: Martin Luther King in the last years of his life, Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Abraham Herschel, and Thomas Merton. Because stage six persons are actualizers and incarnators of God's perfect love and will, Fowler declares that it's not blasphemous for someone like Jesus to declare himself the way, the truth, and the life, or for a Sufi poet to proclaim to be a perfect mirror of God. Now that I've briefly laid out the stages, it would seem clear that stages three through five are the stages that I am immediately interested in. Stage three is the most comfortable, but I would argue that ultimately it is not necessarily a healthy stage. Stage 3 Latter-day Saints seem to show little tolerance or criticism from their larger communities. They perpetuate issues of misogyny, racism, spiritual abuse, and sometimes vilify those in later stages. Mormons who articulate their doubts find little empathy or forgiveness from Latter-day Saints in Stage 3. Skeptics are usually looked at with disdain, suspicion, regardless of any previous status or reputation. Fowler talks about how a person's age dictates the stage a person can or will be in. For example, it's improbable that a 21-year-old returned missionary to be in Stage 5. Though there are other factors, each stage is normally related to a person's age and mental maturity. I would venture that it's probable for someone in their 20s to enter into Stage 4, but I doubt that Latter-day Saints, unless they took particularly thought-provoking courses in college or had endured particularly traumatic experiences in their life, would develop fully into Stage 4 until their mid-30s. I would speculate that 5 would be something Mormons can move into in their 40s and 50s. Stage 6, if achieved at all, would be late in life. Mapping the stages of faith seems to only matter to those who are at or around Stage 4. It's difficult to self-analyze where one is. I initially felt that I was in Stage 5, but I became honest with myself and I realized that I fit somewhere squarely within Stage 4. I'm still angry. Most people in Stage 3 see those who are in Stage 4 as heretics or claim that they never were truly converted in the first place. They can't really wrap their mind around the concept of questioning one's faith for reasons other than sin. Maybe many Latter-day Saints in Stage 3 often feel that individual decisions that differ from the Mormon norm cannot be healthy in the maturation process. After having these stages laid out for them, many of them that I've spoken with, who are obviously Stage 3, have expressed that they themselves are really in Stage 5. One went so far as to express that she was in Stage 6. I feel that this is particularly in the response to the belief that because they have labeled me a heretic, or because I proclaim myself as a skeptic, that I must be behind them in the faith development process. For example, after briefly attempting to explain Fowler to an older brother, he told me that he was clearly in Stage 5. He explained that he had wrestled with difficult issues as a missionary and came out the other end a true believer. And in his mind, this was going through the Stage 4 process. It has been my experience that most active members view the world with Stage 3 eyes, and thus generally view those who move into Stage 4 as dangerous, and seem unwilling to allow them the opportunity to move through this process unmolested. Paul Edwards, in his murder mystery, The Angel Acronym, writes, "What I'm talking about is knowledge. Knowledge is lived, not forgiven. We can be forgiven of our deeds, maybe our thoughts, but once you know something, there's no forgiveness because there's no unknowing." I realize that Stage 3 is necessary, and just like 4, this process cannot be skipped. But the reason that Stage 4 may be so painful for some is directly related to the words and actions of those in Stage 3. The Christian ideal of leaving the 99 in God's hands and going to help the one seems to have been retranslated into something that ultimately leaves the one in Stage 4 fending for itself. I found elements of Stage 4 in the writings of a 16th century Catholic mystic who went by the name of St. John of the Cross. He calls what Fowler terms as Stage 4 as the dark night of the soul, declaring this phenomenon as a gift from God and a training ground for learning higher principles. Quote, "When they believe that the sun of divine favor is shining upon most brightly upon them, God turns out this light on their... God turns all this light of theirs into darkness and shuts against them the door of the source of the sweet spiritual water which they were tasting in God. For as they were weak and tender, there was no door closed to them. And thus he leaves them so completely in the dark that they know not whither to go with their sensible imagination and meditation. For they cannot advance a step in meditation as they are wont to aforetime, their inward senses being submerged in this night and left with such dryness that not only do they experience no pleasure and consolation in the spiritual things and good exercises wherein they are wont to find their delights and pleasures, but instead, on the contrary, they find insipidity and bitterness in the said things. For as I have said, God now sees that they have grown a little and have become strong enough to lay aside their swaddling clothes and to be taken from the gentle breast, so he sets them down from his arms and teaches them to walk on their own feet." Close quote. I sense that I am in this dark night of the soul. I feel that I can no longer wrap my mind around the idea that God might actually exist, and that if he does, that he might actually be willing to communicate with humanity my community, or me personally. I know some Latter-day Saints who I feel fit the Stage 5 mold. Quietly, deep inside, I feel that they have sold out. For example, I feel that one of the reasons that they return to a belief in deity is that they are in denial of the idea that after we die that we cease to exist. In my immaturity, I often feel that I'm ahead of them in the life process because of my acceptance of this idea. I realize that this may be akin to those in Stage 3 thinking that I am a heretic. The thing that draws me most to the ideas of Stage 3 is that for the first time in my life, I have the tools to describe my experience. Though not a perfect system, I have a framework that I can verbalize and experiment with. For example, I can compare Stages 1 through 3 with the Mormon concept of the 3 degrees of heaven. Stage 1 being celestial, Stage 2 being terrestrial, and Stage 3 being compared to the happiness of the celestial kingdom. Stage 4 is the restarting of the process with the painful celestial, Stage 5 terrestrial, and Stage 6 a celestial or exaltation. It's almost as though God gave us a grade school version of the plan of happiness, but upon entering Stage 4, He's now giving us the college level version. I also like the ladder analogy. For some people may have a foot in Stage 3. Most of them are in 4, and some have a handle in Stage 5. Or some may have a toe in Stage 2, but be mostly in Stage 3. Stages can be played out in a multidimensional fashion. A person's Mormonism can be in Stage 5, but their unwillingness to look critically at the life of Jesus places their Christianity at Stage 3. Mary Beth Raines points out, in Stage Theory, we are primarily at one stage at a time, but we can have experiences from several other stages at any time. There doesn't seem to be any limit to Stage Theory's ability to describe the human journey. I feel that I can argue that the LDS Church itself loosely reflects Stage Theory. The Joseph Smith story has elements that attempt to mix myth with reality. The Church found out that part of the world would embrace it, and yet there was a great deal of physical danger, all elements of Stage 1. The Church in early Utah was clearly tribal. Mormons and Gentiles, and the Mountain Meadows Massacre has a feel of Stage 2. I felt that the Church blossoms into Stage 3 in 1958 with the publication of Mormon Doctrine by Bruce R. McConkie. And now in the 21st century, we find leaders of the Church rethinking many traditional doctrines and policies such as the nature of God, blacks as Satan's representatives, and the literalness of our Orthodox history as we move swiftly into the Information Age. Currently, the Church's website contains 5 essays that concede that the American Indians are not necessarily descendants of the Lamanites. These statements directly contradict the statement that the Lamanites are the principal ancestors of the American Indians found in the introduction of our current edition of the Book of Mormon. I speculate that the Internet will be a significant factor that helps the Church grab a firm hold in Stage 4. One could also point to the leadership of the Community of Christ, formerly the RLDS Church, as a Mormon religion that's pulling itself into a Stage 5 prototype. Its efforts to grapple with its history in real terms, its move towards diversification of its highest leadership, and a clear focus that God is real and effective in their lives appears to be a Stage 5 organizational model. That's up for debate. Conclusion. As mentioned previously, Stage Theory appears to be meaningful once a person begins to experiment with issues relating to Stage 4. I sometimes find it frustrating that my tradition is controlled mostly by Stage 3 individuals. Individuals who easily label and dismiss those attempting to take a more skeptical look at the world around them. A person moving into Stage 4 risks losing his or her status among family, friends, neighbors, but more importantly, their marriage, and sometimes their employment. My transition into Stage 4 has been a painful process, and one that I'm frankly hesitant to inflict on others. It's a difficult balance of wanting to be understood, while the very act of being understood offers the potential to the other to experience cognitive dissonance. A recent bishop asked me about my concerns about the Church. By venting any number of issues, I would be placing a kind-hearted bishop at risk with having to deal with questions that I feel he has no answer to. It would be difficult for him to provide light on issues that I have fumbled for years as an insider in the LDS book trade. In all honesty, I feel that I have many of the answers. They're just not the answers I wanted. As a bookseller, I often find very bright young people in a collision course with Stage 4, and there is no grasp by their leaders or community about their experience. They are often told to stop reading, stop listening to Satan, start obeying their leaders implicitly, start listening to the Spirit. This dismissive rhetoric only alienated me farther from those whom I would normally seek advice, and I'm sure it's having the same effect on others. We're not stupid. We're not listening to Satan. We're just going through a stage. I'm fortunate to have had several years to absorb Fowler's work with people who will discuss these stages in a serious way. I'm sure that many members of the church are forced to suffer quietly as they have no outlet nor the tools to describe their situation. Progress and maturity is based on one's ability to understand the events and feelings he or she experiences. Fowler gives us tools to articulate to others our spiritual journey. Our abilities to make sense of the world will in time empower us to live fuller, more meaningful lives. A little learning is a dangerous thing. Drink deep or taste not the Pyrenean spring. There shallow droughts intoxicate the brain, and drinking largely sobers us again. Thank you.
I apologize for that first 10 minutes of fumbling up here. I have absolutely left my notes somewhere else, and that might be a good thing. Who knows? I know what I wanted to say, and luckily I have the book, which at least will prompt me where I get stuck. Who's read Fowler's Stages of Faith? Okay, about half of you. Those who hadn't, you got a sort of a sense for these key stages, stage three. Others are the authority figures for you. You feel content. You're comfortable in your own skin. The world makes a lot of sense to you. Stage four comes along. What happens? All of a sudden, you have to make that shift where you figure it out for yourself. And that's the difficult one. And Tom's just dead on right. It's not until you're about at that stage four cusp that a book like Jim Fowler's book will even make a dent in your radar screen. I had to read it as part of a graduate school course. My very first semester, probably my first 5-6 weeks in my religious studies master's degree, didn't make a dent on me. And yet half my classmates were just thinking this is the world's greatest book. And I just couldn't figure it out. Come along 7 years later, Jim Fowler on a plane, and I was so needing what I found here that it just it turned my life upside down. For the next 3 years, I read nothing but stage theory. I see that Kenny's brought Faithful Change, which was actually I'd read this years before, but that was the first one that I'd read because that was the one that Fowler had just published when I met him on the plane, and he says, hey, when you go to the conference, you ought to pick that up because he sensed that I needed some things there. Then went to this, went on to Ken Wilber's work. I don't know if any of you know his work. Jenny Wade's work, where you now tie in brain development and even the physical structures in the brain and what the brain is capable of. It just has turned out to be a really rich thing and really prepared me, I think, in many ways for taking the role that I now play in Sunstone these last 4 or 5 years, three and a half years, because it did help, as Tom says, for us to feel calmer about people at other stages and to know that every stage is important and you can't skip them. And if you do skip them, then some part of you doesn't quite mature and it'll come back as some sort of dysfunction or something later. So anyway, just know that I highly recommend it for those of you who haven't. I think it was just so comforting for me to know that I was on a journey that other people had been on, and that it sort of fit a pattern. And the best thing about it is the descriptions of stage 5 and stage 6, to know that there's hope ahead, that there was hope for clarity and some sort of peace beyond the craziness of the dark night, or, you know, among other metaphors. So anyway, that's just my preamble to that. I wanted to echo something that Tom did, but I really can't reconstruct my notes there. But he has a pretty interesting little thing about stages 1 through 3, and then you start over with 4, 5, and 6. And I, without my notes, I can't quite think this quickly at the end of a long symposium. But it was very interesting. It's the same developmental tasks in stage 1 and stage 4, and that's feeling the world for yourself, understanding if the universe is a friendly place or not. Again, stage 4 is a complete rethinking of what's the universe like. But this time it's for yourself rather than what you've accepted. Stages two is a mythic stage where Tom talks about you're in your story. Stage five is where you learn to reappropriate your story. And so his little 1, 2, 3 graduate, you know, elementary school and graduate school is really quite an insightful thing. And I wish I was ready to prepare to show you it too. But also stage six, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I'm a perfect mirror for God. Is sort of like the confidence of a bad stage three person, you know. Anyway, so you know, I just wanted to compliment Tom because I was the one who kind of introduced him to Fowler, and he's done some neat and creative things on his own. I really appreciate those. The thing I want to talk about mostly relates to the role I play at Sunstone, and I'll just think out loud with you guys for a minute. Fowler, in his final chapter here called Faith on Earth, brings in the work, I can't remember the fellow's name, but he talks about the modal developmental level that traditions reach. So let me just read you the definition of this. The modal developmental level is the average expectable level of development for adults in a given community. In faith terms, it refers to the conscious or unconscious image of adult faith toward which the educational practices, religious celebrations, and patterns of governance in a community all aim. The modal level operates as a kind of magnet in religious communities. Patterns of nurture prepare children and youth to grow up to the modal level, but not beyond it. The operation of the modal level in a community sets an effective limit on the ongoing process of growth in faith. Did you catch what's going on there? That every tradition, he says, sort of has the ideal, the perfect ideal of this is what it means to be a spiritual grown up. And yet Fowler goes on to argue, and Tom sort of echoes that through his own work here, that most churches really operate on a high level 3 or just maybe a titch into 4 as far as the consciousness that they sort of expect adults to reach. And that when adults reach, like he says here, it's kind of a magnet. When you reach beyond it, what there are forces that are actually pulling you back, saying don't do it. We see this sort of I've always dangerous when I do this, when I'm talking off the cuff, so I apologize, but sometimes in black families or something, what happens when the child wants to go to college, or what happens when they, sometimes the language may be changed, what's the claim? You're acting white. Isn't this good enough for you? You know, you know, what's wrong with the life that we've lived here that you want to go off to college? You know, and I saw something on TV about Latin American women going to college, and they're wrestling with those things and things like that. And so there's this magnet whenever you're in a community that says, don't stretch beyond us. And so what I really wanted to focus on, and this is where I really wish I had my notes, but I do have the book to help a little bit here, is Fowler then goes on to just suggest three or so things that communities can do and sort of to develop, a more comforting place for someone to reach beyond that modal developmental level for that tradition. So the first one, I'll just have to read you the paragraph. It all begins with taking ongoing faith development into adulthood seriously. I believe that when a community expects and provides models for significant continuing faith development in adulthood, its patterns of nurturing the faith of children and youth will change and become more open-ended. What might providing for an ongoing adult development mean? So in other words, it starts with a tradition saying, we recognize that, you know, we're not done learning at basically what, seminary level, or what would that be? That, I mean, I taught at the MTC, and I taught senior couple missionaries for 3.5 years. And it was very interesting for me to just even note then, and I was still true believer, stage 3 all the way kind of guy, but I said, you know, I bet they learned that story in seminary or in mutual, and they're still telling it at age 65, 66 as the answer to a question. And now that I've, you know, kind of got a sense here that that's really, so we need to sort of take seriously that we should continue to develop into adulthood and not just let those answers. And, you know, and now I'm on the gospel bus and I've learned what I need to learn and I'm going to go there. So anyway, bad extra stuff there. Sorry, I mean, I'm not being articulate, so I'm going to move on here. But that's the point there. The second one, is he's trying to get us to transition what faith means. And this is one where I think this is a good place. Sunstone is a place to at least wrestle with this, and I hope that maybe afterwards somebody would want to comment on this and to see, you know, because it's in my brain. So hang on here as we try this one out here. But I'm not going to read it. I'll just tell you what it is. I know what it's talking about. It is taking faith and a worry away from propositions and statements and, you know, this is a truth or this isn't a truth, and turning faith into a relational thing, a community thing, a place where instead of, you know, worrying orthodox or heterodox, we basically worry about each other. We worry to support each other and to be nurturing to each other and so forth. So he says, then what happens with the stories and the myths that sort of seem at first to set out for you as propositions to be believed or not believed, he says, then you're freed up to sort of look at them as experiments, as stories that you can play with. Did anybody come to Frances Menlo this morning? She was playing with the story of the publican and all that stuff, and use them as an example of past communities' experiments with truth. But then you move on and talk about, you know, using those same texts in a new and interesting way where we're experimenting with truth among each other. And then, actually, probably it was the third one that's more Sunstone-oriented. Well, of course, the third one's too easy for Sunstone. We know this one for us. Communities that call persons into ongoing adult development and faith will not fear the intimacy of conflict, nor the inevitable presence in growing faith of doubt and struggle. Provision will be made for adults to bring their struggles with faith to word. And then there's the best part. Before prescriptions are offered, and without condemnation or accusation, they will be given the help of active listening in order to tell their present stories and visions of faith and to hear those of others. That's the one that to me is the most important. The one that probably Sunstone already provides. I guess the one I wanted to sort of... Let me close with that. Anyway, those are just some thoughts, and I really recommend the book, but let me just think out loud quickly as Sunstone guy. Dangerous, it seems to me, to start saying Sunstone is trying to develop Mormon adults' spirituality. Do you agree with that, or is that language I should stay away from? go. Well, because I'm thinking it out loud, and I don't dare write it. But in some ways, I was sort of bringing it up with Sean McCraney this morning. I don't know if any of you were in that session about Christian stuff. And there is sort of there's an offensiveness to say I'm a spiritual adult and you're not. Yeah, it is. And again, and like Tom says, you know, he thinks certain people are copping out, and they can't see that he is on a good path. Just like he can't see that somebody who's finally calming down and maybe seeing the paradox through is on a good path. And so it's a very dangerous thing to start saying mature, immature, or something like that. So how is it that we could, is there a way that I can articulate Sunstone in that direction? And maybe I'm taking way too long. So maybe, can I just... No, that's the beautiful thing. And when you understand this, there is no good and bad in any of this. There's no moral judgment. But it's a strategic move that I'm worried about making. So Holly, quickly, and then we'll probably have to save it for Q&A. But anyway, somehow or other in my other notes, it would have invited this much more calmly. Or at least recognizing that probably on their own they're doing that, and we're a good place for it. Okay. 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 Terrific. And welcoming them with their ways to our forums as well. Thank you. The comment was, as long as we didn't assume that there was exactly a particular outcome that we had in mind and that it was all going to look the same for every person. Is that sort of a summary of what you're saying, Holly? That was for the tape purposes. Anyway, thank you for listening to a rambling fool, but I will always tell you that this has been one of the most important things of my life. It's not the end all. Stage theory is just a tool, but boy, I was sure grateful when I found it. Richard? Yes, Joan Rivers, oh, grow up was the comment. Thank you, everybody. Thanks.
As both Dan and Tom have mentioned, stage theory is simply a tool, and a very useful and instructive one at that. I, however, would like to address some of its limitations, at least the limitations that I see in not necessarily in stage theory, but in Fowler's exploration of stage theory as applied to spiritual growth. First of all, we're using a scientific tool or modeling and applying it to a non-scientific or internal experience. And there's a bit of a paradox there in so doing. Trying to quantify or qualify the subjective necessitates the use of very vague language. I've handed out a summary. These are Fowler's own words, but a summary of the four stages that are being discussed here today. And if you read that, you realize this isn't the most musical language that you're ever going to read. And there's a certain vernacular, or not vernacular, there's a certain locution that he uses that can be very troubling. For example, spiritual compositions was a phrase that just puzzled the hell out of me for the longest time. I kept thinking of writing essays and realizing we were talking about a composite of spiritual growth. And he does this a lot, and I think that that's not to his criticism. Simply, it's just a requirement of discussing the internal as if it were an external experience that could be quantified and qualified. Richard Mitchell, The Underground Grammarian, in a very controversial book that I like a lot, is called, the title of the work is Less Than Words Can Say. And the quote that applies here, I think, from that book is that if you can't say it, you can't know it. That's a very controversial thing to say, but I personally believe it's true. How often we find ourselves saying, I know what I mean, I just can't put it into words. No, you don't know what you mean. That's why you can't put it into words. And I think that's the territory that we and Fowler are treading here. We don't know. We're trying to come to a knowledge, and so it's necessitated that we use purposefully vague language and sometimes self-contradicting language. Let me give you an example we've talked. One of the things that was mentioned is that Tom has taken this. This particular book and tried to employ it in a Mormon context. And that in and of itself is difficult because I think that although we've said that you have to be at a certain stage within your spiritual development before you can recognize the usefulness of the book, I also think that it might be useful to be in another religion in order to be able to use this book. I do mean that somewhat comically, but I'm also speaking seriously. I think there's something about not being mainstream Christian that makes it difficult for Mormons to take Fowler and to implement Fowler with a full enough understanding. Maybe if you see, Dan has the advantage of having gone to school and delved into subjects such as theology and religious philosophy and things like that, which the average Mormon doesn't really get and never will get, not within the confines of the church. So it can be very problematic for a Mormon to read this book and not misunderstand. For example, It's just human nature that there be cognitive dissonance when our behavior, when one's behavior suddenly is in conflict with one's set of values. That cognitive dissonance can be psychically painful, and there's only two choices, only two things that can be done to resolve that cognitive dissonance. Either or the reverse, you change your behavior back to meet your values, and there's really no way of getting around that. The former, human nature being what it is, the former is more common than the latter. We usually change our values to meet our behavior. within an LDS context, this is the equivalent of saying, this is nonsense, I'm out of here. The latter is, in a Mormon context, more in the it's more the equivalent of repenting and getting back to some form of orthodoxy in behavior, repenting and moving on. The former is actually moving from stage two to stage three. It's not moving from stage three to stage four, as is commonly believed by those who I've given the book to. Have given me similar responses to the one Tom mentions about, you know, I had these terrible thoughts in the mission field and I dealt with them and now I'm stage five. And just because you're ticked off with your bishop, he's offended you, and you've remained inactive for 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 years, and then you've moved back into the bosom of the community of saints, that is not a movement from stage three to stage four. Because it's not a movement from orthodoxy to non-orthodoxy. It's actually a readaptation of your behavior toward orthodoxy. It is the latter of changing. Changing one's values to meet one's behavior is more a movement of three to four by saying, this is a load, and you know I'm not going to put up with this anymore. And so you reorder your life, as Dan was saying. He pointed out that moving from one to three, and then is not the same as moving from three to four. You're actually starting over again in a sense, and that is a movement. When you move from three, you're moving from orthodoxy into four, which is heterodoxy. As Fowler says, since most of the reasons behind moving from stage three to stage four involve serious clashes or contradictions between valued authority sources. See, that's a nice phrase there, James. Authority sources. How about authorities? Nothing like economy of speech. Marked by changes of officially sanctioned leaders or policies or practices previously deemed sacred or unbreachable, or the encounter with experiences of perspectives that lead to critical reflection of how one's beliefs and values have formed and changed, and on how relative they are to one's particular group or background. Now, because movement from three to four involves these kinds of things, that movement usually involves anger. And that is one of the reasons, one of the sticking points, that one of the reasons why I believe that as Fowler states, most adults remain in stage four for the rest of their lives because of the anger. There's another sticking point, but let's explore that first one. Anger is a secondary emotion. It's really not a primary emotion. You have to peel back the onion and look underneath the anger to find out what it is you're really feeling. It's usually fear or frustration or a sense of betrayal. And once you've been able to discover the actual undercurrent there, underneath the anger, then you have I think you have a more healthy toolbox with which to work. And maybe in putting aside the anger, one can then move on to stage five a little more readily. Another sticking point is that moving from stage three to stage four invariably ends up
One ends up entertaining agnosticism or even atheism. And there's a paradox in an atheist trying to assess his or her spiritual growth. And very often that's where one comes to a sense of paralysis there. And it's a cognitive paralysis. You really can't get your head, you don't believe anymore in there being anything remotely of the nature of the soul. So why bother? Why worry about it? Just, you know, live your life and do the best that you can. And so there's an ending of a search there in when one gives into that kind of thinking. Not that life can't knock you off that perch. You can maintain that agnostic or atheistic perch for a number of years or for a significant period of time and then be knocked off of it and move on again. But those are the two sticking points that I believe need to be watched out for when we're assessing whether are we stuck in stage four or not. Another major problem I find with Fowler's development of his stage development here is the movement between four and five is not a reconciliation, and it's all and when you read the language it's very confusing. It sounds very often as if he's speaking about a reconciliation, and it is not and cannot be. You come to that point in the river where you can't swim backwards anymore. You're going over the falls. You're at a point of no return. And I'm speaking about the movement from four to I was speaking about the movement from four to five. The point of no return is during the movement of three to four. You cannot hit four and go back to three. That is it's impossible. So you can be stuck in four for the rest of your life. Or you can move on to five. But in moving on to five, you are not reconciling yourself again and arriving back at stage three. You have moved on to a new territory. And this is a very discomforting territory. Fowler makes it sound rather peachy, and Fowler's not a Mormon. If you, for example, suddenly find yourself at a stage where your commitment to justice is freed from the confines of tribe, class, religious community, or nation, you don't smell like anything except other. You have become one of those insects that's entered the ant hive, and they can smell your chemicals. And they kill you. They know you're not one of them, and you can't help but not smelling right. You just don't smell right. It's not even a conscious thing. The vernacular of the collective is forgotten. You don't know the appropriate tone of voice. You don't know the appropriate vocabulary. You once knew it, but you don't know it anymore, and you don't even know what topics are really discussable. And you often find yourself just smelling wrong, and that's why when you hit stage five, you're not reconciling yourself and going back to stage three. You have labeled you raised your hand in the community, and you've said, "Guess what? I'm not one of you." And that leads us to an ethical problem. Before I get into the ethical problem, the reason why I made the mention of Fowler's not a Mormon, and therefore I don't think he would understand my objection here, is because in mainstream Christianity, unless you're into some of the more evangelical branches of Christianity, there's really a lot of leeway in mainstream Christianity. I mean, you don't like what this minister is saying, you can go to another congregation. And I had to laugh out loud once. I was driving and listening to Dr. Laura, and she recommended that to a man who was calling in who was LDS, and she said, "Well, why don't you go find another bishop that's more amenable to you?" You know, and I just laughed, and I said, "Well, obviously she needs an email and some instructions on how this works." So I think that when you look at the non-mainstream nature of Mormonism, because it's non-mainstream, there is a stronger emphasis on belonging, on an us against them kind of dichotomy. And not that there's anything wrong with that, but that sense of inclusion and identity is more imperative among Mormons and say, evangelicals than it would be among mainstream Christians such as Presbyterians or Lutherans or so forth. Okay, I'm behind. I will close with the ethical question. If you find yourself with ties to be because of family, because of employment or what have you, and because of a yearning to remain part of the community, is it unethical then to allow people to assume, others to assume your orthodoxy? And I think that if someone answers that question with yes, it's unethical, that's a stage 3 ethic. And I think a stage 5 ethic can encompass just becoming comfortable within the community of the saints and allowing people to believe what they're going to believe, and not feeling compelled, as you would in a stage 3, to make sure that your orthodoxy was very clear and very well known. Thank you.
Are you that tall? Well, I appreciate being here today. You know, a panel discussion is a lot of fun, but the more we get down the list, the more you're going to hear the things that either we disagree with each other or we say the same things over and over again. But I read Fowler's book when it first came out, and I was enlightened by it, I thought. And being a curious person and also a skeptic, I found it kind of useful to me to find out, you know, at least gave an idea or a theory of why things are the way they are, how things come about. And if you're particularly curious about, you know, these kinds of things, then I'd suggest you get a Fowler's book or look at it again. I'd like to make a few comments on Fowler's description of adults found in the first four stages and see if we can relate them more to our experience in church, especially to adults. I mean, we know that 1 and 2, for example, happen in childhood, but what happens if a person stays in stage 1 or stage 2 into adulthood? And I think that's more important to us as participants in Mormonism. We also have to keep in mind that, you know, we hear all these descriptions of stage theory, and we have to keep in mind that most of these are theoretical. Fowler, in his many studies with lots, 600 people and so forth, He seems to, or at least claims to, have validated the first four stages, but he does, even Fowler himself, doesn't claim to have validated stages 5 and 6. Those are still, you know, open for conjecture and our own interpretations. But as Tom mentioned, stage 1 occurs during childhood, when one learns the taboos and the attendance habits and the cultural expectations and the symbolisms of our religions. And his description of an adult stuck in stage 1 may be recognized by some of us. He says an adult in stage 2. An adult in stage 1 is a person with a very rigid, brittle, and authoritarian personality. You know, if you think back to the ward you grow up in, for example, I can think of one of my friend's dads seemed to fit into that stage pretty well. Maybe. You know, I'm a skeptic about all these things, but in stage 2, a child incorporates the stories, beliefs, morals, and symbols of the religion into his life. And if a person stays in stage 2 as an adult, this person is going to see the world as based on a literal reciprocal fairness and justice. And so, you know, blessings come from obedience. You know, sin is going to give you misfortunes and penalties and so forth. And basically, life is a formula. And again, you can probably think of ward members who would champion the idea of life being a formula. You know, if you pay your tithing, you will get blessed. If you don't pay, you're not going to get blessed. That kind of thing, maybe even worse. But still, it's not a very, it's kind of fun to think about, but I don't think it's a perfect fit. And stage 3, as all of our panelists have mentioned, is suggestive of the most active Latter-day Saints, those who are strongly influenced by interpersonal relationships. The stage 3 person, adult, is well tuned into the expectations and judgment of others. And these people have a cluster of beliefs and values that they live by. but they rarely think about them or examine them in any way. And authority always rests in worthy others. And there's kind of a script that we all memorize. Dan mentioned this, about, you know, 65-year-old people giving the mutual answers. And he and I had a discussion. And when I go to my high priest group meeting, it seems like we're doing kind of a script. There's a standard question, and then there's a standard answer, and the person feels real proud of themselves, and there's a little, you know, a silent clapping. Yeah, yeah, you got the right answer. You know, there's no discussion. It's just, you know, here's the answer. Yeah, thank you. So I think in terms of stage theory, this stage three seems to pretty well fit for Latter-day Saints. I think it's the best of the four stages that Fowler described that fits Mormonism. It occurred to me, too, while we were talking that, you know, it seems like most Republicans also fit in this stage one. Maybe stage two, I don't know. You know, don't come after me, please. The stage four adult is no longer sustained by others, adapts an independence in reactions, interpretation, and judgments of life, and authority and responsibility pass from others to herself or himself. And stage four people feel the conflicts. We see the irony in life, and we experience the pulls and tensions of different points of view. And I think most people at Sunstone probably relate to this stage four kind of life. I certainly do. If I had to peg myself someplace, I'd probably figure I'm mostly in four. But so, you know, according to Fowler, he reasonably well described the four classes of religiosity, and he has, through his study, demonstrated that many fit well into these four stages. But I'm kind of curious. I'm like, Scott, I don't know if it fits the LDS tradition that well, because we have a little bit different system in our church than other faith organizations. We don't even call ourselves a faith organization. You know, we champion testimony and having a knowledge of the truthfulness and so forth. It's more a black and white kind of a organization. You know, gaining a testimony is primary, and you know, talking about a faith-based life like found in most other churches is considered secondary or and not very recognizable. If you talk to mainstream Mormons, I mean, they wouldn't even recognize exactly what you're talking about a faith-based life. So I'm not sure that Fowler's stage theory can fit perfectly to Mormonism. Another problem for me is that Fowler fails to explain some very important questions of development for me, you know, progression through these stages. You know, the three questions that popped out in my mind when I first read the book and still are there. Why does a person sojourn in stage two or three while another one moves on to stage four without any apparent effort or intention to do so? And how do we motivate ourselves and other adults to progress from one stage to another? And finally, should we be doing that? Should we be encouraging people to go from stage three to stage four or from stage four to stage five? I don't know. And he doesn't give us any ideas about that, as far as I can tell, except for organizations. You know, there's many classification schemes. I mean, I thought of one while we were sitting here. You probably recognize this. Here's this classification scheme. There's a temple recommend holder, the active Mormon, the less active Mormon, the Jack Mormon, and the apostate. And there's a stage theory that we could go through. but there was a pretty good classification scheme that I heard from, maybe some of you remember him, Dr. R. Jan Stout. Remember him, psychiatrist? In 1983, he gave a paper at the Sunstone Symposium describing a stage theory that he developed. It was pretty good. In fact, I think it's maybe better than Fowler's scheme, because Jan was a Mormon psychiatrist and he was working with Mormons. And I mention it because it illustrates that we should not rely too much on any one grouping system or any one classification system at all, or at all for that matter. But Dr. Stout suggested that he could identify four groups of LDS adults who arrived at their final religious positions from the complex interplay of anxiety, social forces, and life experiences. And these are the four classes. They're pretty self-explanatory. The first group is the submissive and dependent Mormon. And the second group is the social and organizational Mormon. These two kind of fit with Fowler's stage three. And then the third group was the skeptic and individualistic Mormon, which kind of fits with Fowler's stage four. And finally, there was a group four, the Selfless and Universal Mormon, which he put people like President Kimball and so forth. Stage five, that kind of fits Fowler's stage five. These groups are self-identifying. I'm not going to take any time to read it. You could look back in the 83. I don't know if it got printed in Sunstone or not, but maybe it did. Was it in there, actually? Okay. No matter whose classification scheme we use, and it is curious and interesting to look at them, we can usually find a suitable stage, group, or class for almost anybody, generally, but some traits of each group can be found in every person. I see parts of myself in all of Fowler's stages depending on the time, place, and circumstances of the moment. Sometimes I can even send myself as a five, you know, but mostly sometimes two, three, four in those, depending on the time and the issue that's going on. I think the most important thing is to recognize that there should be ample room in the LDS Church for all stages, all groups, all classes, and all types of good, honest people. Anyone desiring fellowship, even those attending the symposium. Thank you.
I'm Kenny Kemp. I'm in a unique position where I sell my books equally in the evangelical Christian market and the LDS market, and no one knows who I am. Every year I go to the Christian Book Expo, and this last week I attended the Mormon Book Expo, and they really are so astonishingly similar that it's only a difference in size. We have the Angel Moroni socks, and they've got the holographic Jesus with the crown on his head who winks at you when you walk by. A little bit about me so that you can, this is a disclaimer for what I say. I'm a single man who graduated from BYU three times, a fifth generation Mormon who's been inactive for 10 years. I'm not a Sunstone attender. I don't believe in Sunstone. I don't believe in the Mormon Church, just so you know. My point of view is this. I'm really fascinated with this movement between Stage 4 and Stage 5. If you accept for a moment, and I don't, but I'm going to ask us all to for just a moment, the possibility that Fowler's onto something, then most of the people in this room would probably on some level have to say, yeah, I'm probably in stage four because the littlest things piss me off. Is this being recorded?
Oh, yeah.
And having spent a large part of my adult life in that mode, I first came to Sunstone in that mode and saw a lot of kindred spirits which grieved my soul because I hate that mode. It is not the happy place to be, and it wasn't the end of my journey. And what I want to take is 2 minutes and tell you that I do believe with all my heart that there is a way to get into stage five. If only that I know it exists, maybe I have not yet traveled it. In John Krakauer's book, Under the Banner of Heaven, he makes the case repeatedly, pointedly, and painfully that the basis of Mormonism, its strength and its weakness, is its idea of an individual relationship with God. It is the same type of a concept that leads Joseph Smith to go into a grove and to walk out and change the religious world. It's also the same thing that caused Ron Lafferty to walk into his brother's house and murder his wife and child. Siddhartha, the first Buddha, said, if you meet a Buddha on the road, you must kill him. I think the key to moving between the stages is to take seriously the notion of individual revelation. The idea that you would get the Holy Ghost when you were baptized and be privy to a personal relationship with the Master of the Universe immediately cuts out the middleman. And it cuts out every kind of middleman that I can think of, including my mother and Gordon Hinckley. And everybody in between. This is an onerous burden and is not a happy place to be unless you believe there is a stage five where you will achieve happiness and joy and above all, acceptance of everybody else and yourself and all your outrageous weaknesses and your lofty strengths. To get to stage five, you have to become an individual and secure in your own soul. I would also wager that very few of us are there. That there's a bit of anger and frustration in us, and we don't know where to go. From this, I go to the holy grail of all storytelling. I am a storyteller, and I go to Lord of the Rings. I think Frodo is a perfect example of a stage progression. In the Shire, he's in the stage one. He's in infancy. He's surrounded by love, by friends, by family. Surrounded in a place where they have great parties and fireworks. And they're also surrounded, but they don't know it, by the rangers and Gandalf, the wizards, who protect them. They don't even know they exist. And then one day God walks into the Shire and chooses one of the hobbits and gives him a ring, which is his doom. The double meaning of doom is not only is it a bad thing, but it's your destiny to do it. He gives him the ring and says, oh, by the way, you must take this ring into the heart of darkness, the crack of doom. And so he sends Frodo on this great journey. Well, Frodo goes on this journey at first with several friends, whom they call the Fellowship. It starts out with just his two friends or three friends from his hometown so that he's comfortable on his trip. To this I liken religion. Religion is leaving home and going to home. Even though it's in a big church building, it's still home. You're still surrounded by people who share your views of the world. But soon in the book, the Fellowship breaks apart, and pretty soon Frodo is making his travel with just one friend. Well, actually two, but he doesn't recognize them both as friends. One friend is his servant Sam, who in the book is a true servant. He's in the movie, he's more of a companion, but in the book he's a servant. I liken him to our conscience. He's the only person in the series who's never completely fooled. He knows at all time what Gollum has in mind. Now, of course, Gollum is a hobbit. A lot of people who see the movies don't know that. That he's actually a degraded hobbit. And he is the shadow of Frodo. He's the other side of the coin. Well, as they travel toward Mount Doom, the Fellowship breaks apart. And even at the time where Frodo must enter to destroy the ring, Sam gets belayed. And he's in there at the crack of doom by himself with only his shadow. And the shadow wins. By the shadow gets the ring, and that is the only way that Frodo can give it up. Now, I don't want to play too much on the ending, although I find that fascinating to think about, letting that shadow side of us go on some level. What I really want to say is that I think it's an individual moment. And I think, although I honor and love all organizations that help like-minded people come together and talk about how shitty it is to be like-minded, or how loving it is to be like-minded, whatever, I think in the end, when you stand before in your own crack of doom, you better know God. And if you know God, you won't care who else is there or who isn't there. You may be delightfully surprised to know that there's many fellow travelers on the road, but you will not share your life with one. You'll have to do it. I think in the end, contrary to Mormon belief, we are individuals, lonely, empty souls most of the time. I think the best we can hope for in this universe is to have friends who love us and who will be there for us. But in the end, we must face God. And the true promise and peril of Mormonism is the notion that you could do that. And to all of us who struggle within the church, I would say, use it for what it's worth. Use it for its benefits, its qualities, its good things. Let it be what it, and let it alone for what it isn't. Forgive it for not being with you at your own crack of doom. Forgive it for not having all the answers that your mommy told you it would have. And then in the end, listen as the Lord speaks to your heart, and He will guide you. You know, I believe that with all my heart, and it, on, like Mr. Burton said, I probably fit in all those stages, but in the little tiny microscopic electron microscope portion of me that knows there is a stage five, I know that the key to going there is love and to forgive all people and to quit thinking so much in terms of what I know and what you don't know and what I can share with you. You know, what I'm more excited about is to know that I'm not alone on the road. And my core belief that keeps me still even interested in Mormonism is the notion that there are people who've trod this road before me. And I might know of a couple of them. One of those was Jesus Christ. And it's just an astonishing notion that he would look back over his shoulder and say, well, you know, you can make it. So, thank you.
Wow. Hey, we have about 10 minutes. The thing is being recorded, so if you have a question, if you'd mind, why don't you come on up and say it into the tape, please.
Holly.
I wonder if the two of you would respond to the idea raised by Tom, something that maybe grows out of that. Tom, you said that stages 4, 5, and 6 may be the graduate level repetition of stages 1, 2, 3. I don't know anything, but I love this stage model, and I think I'm getting into something similar to stage 5 finally, after a lot of suffering in stage 4. I still don't have the kind of joy, just pure joy, that I experienced in stage 3 many, many times. Would the two of you respond to my hope that Tom's right? No, you two. Yeah, Tom and you, Dan. Have you had thoughts about the possibility that stage 6 brings the joys of stage 3?
Well, first of all, you know, as I stated, I'm an agnostic, and I fear that I will stay there forever. Okay, that's my fear. But I have hope, because I have people that I see, not lots of them, but I have some people that I see around me who I feel that have let go of what I have now and have moved on to something like a stage 5. All I can say is I have hope for what you're talking about, but no, I'm still pissed.
Wow, Rulon, thanks, Rulon. I do have hope for stage 6, and I do sense that there's a joy there, but it's also, as Tom's paper just briefly mentioned, and if you read in Fowler, stage 6, because you're so fully actualized with the will of God, that you're often so controversial that people kill you, like Jesus, you know, like Martin Luther King and things like this. And you know, it's, you're so perfectly reflected, you kind of lose your sense of self-protection and all that stuff. So I'm not positive that the way to look at 6 is joy, except in the terms that when you hear Jesus say, I've descended below all things and now my joy is full, Jesus has opened himself to the wider range of experiences, and therefore those things are more possible for him. So what you considered pure joy, at stage 3, I doubt is what Jesus means by fullness of joy, because of you know what I mean, of that. So I got to think that it's there, but I don't think it's a happy road. I don't know if any of you remember, but I was caught off guard when Peggy Fletcher interviewed me after Gene England died. And she says, do you think there'll be another Gene England? I said, oh, who would want to be another Gene England? With all the grief and all the pain and all the sorrow in that guy's life for opening himself up and to be, you know, the way he was. I truly do believe, I have more confidence than Kenny, that there really is a stage 5 there. And I've got one of those souls that sort of, I'll tell you this, like when I was partying, all my dark years, I'd be in the middle of a bong hit, you know, and my soul would just sort of say, I'm going to go on a mission. And I would blurt it out to my friends, stoned as can be, you know, or something like this. But I've always had that sort of little thing in me that, you know, I'd be doing something wrong, but my soul's crying out. And so what I'm trying to say is now is, there's always these glimpses of a neat stage five, you know, and I'm living there more often than I used to, and stuff.
What I'm